This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. This week, First Nations people and Acadians have a special relationship here in Cape Breton, and they may have more in common than you think. A local historian will tell us about this bond dating back hundreds of years. Organizers of the Lamplight Gala in mid-May are staying tight-lipped on who will be performing, but guarantee they'll be among the elite in the Cape Breton music scene. Bill Bradley will bring you that story later in the program. And with a spike in the rodent population, we'll hear about the facts and the myths in dealing with unwanted guests in your home and on your property. Chad Fleming of Island Pest Control is up first.
I would say that the number one new call driver for business would be in concern with rodents and vehicles. That's the hot button topic that, you know, that's the water cooler topic that, you know, I'm sure everybody either has a friend or a family member or themselves who kind of had to deal with the issue. I would say that's the biggest new development. And that's, of course, as a result of, say, the 2010 big shift in what they use in wiring harnesses now is bioplastic. And the rodents seem to really gravitate towards it. Other than that, it's ever since, you know, this has occurred all over the world, ever since the coronavirus quarantines, rat populations have spread out from centralized locations more and more into residential neighborhoods and found out that, you know, they could be successful there. And they've quite effectively taken over entire neighborhoods, as opposed to isolated incidents, you know, one homeowner maybe, you know, who might have some, you know, undesirable conditions on their property, whether that's, you know, bird feeders that aren't maintained properly or garbage or green bins that aren't, you know, looked after quite, you know, up to snuff. But now it's just ubiquitous through whole neighborhoods.
Chad, can you talk more about how COVID-19 played a role in what looks like a spike in the rodent population around here, especially when we started to see the restaurants shutting down?
And then that's a phenomenon that's been noticed and documented all over the world. So basically, you know, rats, you know, quite reasonably, were tied to point sources of food, right? Whether that was a restaurant dumpster or an elementary school recess yard or, you know, what have you, they're quite content to stay there and exploit that resource. Once, you know, the shift went from dine-in service to exclusively takeout service, you know, those dumpsters or, you know, the school, once, you know, online learning started, those recess yards, they dried up instantly. And then the rats were left kind of holding the bag. They're like, what do we do now? So they, you know, they went out. I'm not saying that they, you know, pulled a Toy Story and followed the delivery truck, but they spread out from those point sources to the neighboring property. So, prime example, of course, you know, I live in Glace Bay. Within 2 weeks of quarantine starting, school, you know, in class being interrupted, the neighborhood, there's a street that's directly next to Glace Bay Elementary. I had calls from half of the homeowners within 2 weeks. Just as fast as that, you know, for rat problems, because you can imagine how many recess snacks go missing during recess at an elementary school. Well, that's a great resource if you're a rat. And nobody sees it, and, you know, no harm done until it dries up. And then, you know, that population that has been successfully exploiting that resource is forced to spread out into the neighboring areas. And then about 2 months after the initial wave, well, then the subsequent new population then spread out again and extended that area. So now all of a sudden, you know, we've got, say, you know, within 200 or 300 feet of that point source, people are, you know, experiencing problems with rodents that maybe they never did before because they weren't the most attractive thing in that area. And then suddenly they were.
Geez, Chad, a gentleman in Ashby told me he trapped 6 rats in 2 days. Are you hearing numbers like that too from your clients?
Well, I mean, you take into account some fairly drastic numbers. So the, you know, the species of rats that we have around here are Norways. We have, you know, And a female Norway rat, the gestation period for a female Norway rat is about 9 weeks. And sexual maturity for her offspring occurs around 5. So it doesn't take a math genius to figure that that's going to get, you know, as long as habitat and food are amenable, you know, there's enough of both. It doesn't take very long for that to get out of control. And they'll forage on average, you know, 100 feet is nothing for them to forage distance-wise, you know, nightly for food. So, you know, when you get your tape measure out and you start looking at your neighbors, it's not even necessarily completely within your control. You know, one neighbor who's struggling with a problem can influence, you know, across the street behind them and two houses down either way. So if you happen to be, you know, more of a symptom of the problem as opposed to the originator of the problem, let's say, that's, you know, not only are you struggling with the problem, but you don't even have control over the full scope of the problem. And that's where a lot of the problems arise. You can do everything that you're supposed to do. You can, you know, maintain your property flawlessly and have no conducive conditions, no harborage, you know, things like shrubbery or, you know, decorative plants right up against your house that offer cover. You can have none of that. But if a neighbor does, you could still feel the brunt of the problem.
So what do you do in a situation like that, Chad? If you generally you get along with your neighbors, but you notice something that could probably be tidied up a little bit, whether it's garbage or another kind of rodent magnet, do you think it's wise to consult like that?
Well, if there's nothing drastic, I mean, rats don't need much, which is part of the problem. You know, you don't actually actively have to be doing something detrimental in order for rats to find you agreeable or your property agreeable. And quite often, you know, that's the situation that we find ourselves in where you can, you know, if you have the experience and the know-how, you can quickly identify, you know, paths to travel and see that, oh, you know, there's an awful lot of traffic coming side to side on this property. So, you know, it's an indication right away that either, you know, they're going to forage at the neighbor or they're coming from the neighbors to forage. And really that foraging behavior, that's all I need. You know, I can fix your neighbor's rat problem so that you don't have a problem. That's not really an issue unless it's severe. You know, if there's, for example, if you've got a vacant lot that's being used as a garbage dumper, you know, or, you know, somebody's got extensive gardens and they're feeding wildlife outside on their property. At that point, I never recommend that kind of clients go head to head with their neighbor. That's very rarely going to be conducive to problem solving. It would be nice to have some assistance, like regulatory assistance in that instance, where a homeowner can turn to, you know, bylaws or their local counselor or whatever, and, you know, have those conducive conditions addressed, you know, as long as they, you know, meet a certain threshold. If somebody's doing something that's contributing to the problem actively, in a meaningful way in a neighborhood, then I would like to think that, you know, they can be educated and come around to, you know, helping the entire neighborhood by, even if it's only temporarily, you know, curtailing an activity that's conducive. You know, like there's typically an easy way to do things and there's a proper way to do things. I'm not against feeding birds, for example. I am about limiting ground fall, so the underbird feeders that provide the resource for rodents. So, you know, if I come upon a client who, you know, actively likes the bird watch and has bird feeders on their property and, you know, has inadvertently attracted a population of rodents, well, then I'm going to educate them on a better way to feed the bird that lets them do what they want to do without the side effect of, you know, running a rodent hospital. That way everybody wins. Except for the rodents, of course.
So there are many ways to prevent rodent infestation. What about the notion that rats are highly intelligent, and regardless of the steps you take to try to catch them or keep them away, they'll figure it out. They'll think something isn't right here. Maybe I'll try another way. Or do you think we're giving them too much credit as far as intelligence goes?
Well, I mean, intelligent, the joke is a lot of time, you know, you'll run into a client who's tried to do it themselves, and they'll quickly determine that, you know, the rat is university educates. And depending on how frustrated they are, it seems like the post-secondary education goes up a notch in prestige, depending on how difficult it's been. But the intelligence might be a bit overblown. They're very adaptive. And, I mean, they're survivors. The old saying goes, you know, it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you. Well, everyone's out to get you if you're a rat. So you're justifiably paranoid about changes in your environment, for example. Most of the time, though, it's something that people fall short on because they think it should be easy. And part of my job is, you know, not just having access to superior quality products, for example, it's understanding behaviors and being able to read, you know, the signs of activity in a home. You know, most people will see a problem and they react to the problem where they see it. So, for example, if a rat ran across your kitchen floor, people are going to go purchase a trap and put it on their kitchen floor. It seems self-explanatory. In reality, it's far from. First of all, I mean, the rats can't see the ceiling. They're fairly short-sighted. So they're really paranoid about birds. So to investigate a new thing on a kitchen floor that they probably only have access to a third of the day because they're going to try and work around the occupant, right? So they don't want to be up while you're up. So now all of a sudden we've got, you know, an attractant, you know, bait on a trap in a hostile, dangerous environment with no cover that's only accessible a third of the day. And then people don't, you know, they don't have success and they're, you know, they're flummoxed. When in reality, you know, all the signs of failure are pretty easy to see if you understand the behavior of the animal. And, you know, obviously, you know, the garden variety homeowner doesn't want to sit and, you know, read all kinds of scientific literature about the behavior of rats. And I don't blame them. You know, that's what I'm for. So, you know, just like anything else, you know, there's certain jobs, you know, that people can DIY. I would say if you're interested in cars, first interaction with DIY service on your car probably shouldn't be your brakes. Sounds kind of perilous to me, right? Maybe one that we want to try with something a little easier. And sometimes that's the exact same thing when it comes to road.
What do you think about the idea of getting a cat, a natural sworn enemy of rodents when all else fails? And I wonder, though, what the SPCA would say on something like that, considering they often suggest people avoid getting someone a kitten or a puppy, for example, for Christmas by February. Many people would get bored and the new pet goes back to the SPCA. So what do you think about that if someone tells you they're going to get a cat to deal with their rodent problem?
I typically, you know, as an animal person myself, I typically recommend that, you know, people should get a pet if they want a pet, even if, you know, the cat can, against the odds, correct the problem long after the problem is gone. The litter box will still be there. So, you know, your mileage may vary on how much you want that animal after a certain point, and that's not fair to the animal. And in reality, you know, in the situation of a cat inside a structure, all the advantages are given to the rat in that situation, right? He's got all kinds of ways to work around the cat, you know, through the wall, following the plumbing and wiring, all kinds of places to hide. The cat is an excellent deterrent predator on the exterior of a home, but we don't basically treat our pets the same way we would have 20 or 30 years ago, where you put the cat out at night and it roams around and kind of polices your property or the neighborhood. We don't do that anymore. So rodents have been allowed to sneak up on our houses. And then once he's inside, he's got all the power. He's got all the advantages, and the cat probably isn't going to, you know, a really good cat that has the instinct to hunt will catch, you know, mice or rats. But it's unlikely that they're going to catch the population in its entirety. And the one claim to fame that rodents have is they're able to outbreed predation successfully most of the time. So I can make more of me before you can eat all of me. So then it just becomes this long, drawn-out battle of attrition between your poor cat and the rodent. And the cat gets to fall back on, you know, fancy feast if it's not successful. The motivation might be a little dodgy there too. So get a cat if you want a cat, right? It's from a pest control perspective, it's very unlikely that, you know, that house cat, domesticated house cat, is going to be the answer to your prayers. You know, a house cat is not a barn cat. Most people aren't going to pick up and start cuddling a barn cat, which is really what you think you want, you know, if you have a rodent problem.
Chad, what do you think about this idea? Let's say someone hears scratching in their walls one night. They realize there's an unwanted guest in their home. They assume the worst, but they soon learn that it's a mouse. Still unpleasant for a lot of people, but they're relieved in the sense because of the old saying that if you have mice in your home, at least it means you don't have any rats. So what do you think about that conversation, and is it in fact true?
That's a valid response to being a mouse as opposed to a rat, because, you know, some people will be scared of mice. The majority of people are just strongly inconvenient, but it's a whole different level of anxiety and misery when it's a rat. So I can understand that, but the problem is the way that saying goes, you know, if you have mice, you don't have rats, what have you. The reason is because rats eat mice. There's a small problem with that equation then. So if you start with rats, you won't have mice, because mice are smart enough to know that we shouldn't go there. However, if you have an out-of-control mouse problem that goes on long enough, mice are basically like little incontinent burglars. And everywhere they go, they leave evidence of where they've been. Well, if you try to take a dog for a walk, I dare you to try to not stop at a telephone pole or a fire hydrant. You're stopping, right? Got to check messages. Well, if you're something that likes to eat mice, you're probably pretty good at tracking mice. So, you know, if there's a hole in your house that's allowing rodents in and out, mice in this case, right? By virtue of them repeatedly entering and leaving, they're going to basically put a big neon eat at your house sign on that opening. And then things that like to eat mice are going to find it. It's unlikely the cats or owls are going to break into your house to, you know, eat mice. So the only real options are things like weasels and rats. Weasels aren't really prevalent in urban areas, so for, you know, most of the time it's going to be rats. So my first inclination is to make sure that people understand that however you choose to rectify the problem, you shouldn't let it be prolonged, because you're actually increasing your risk of attracting rats.
Okay, moving on a bit, Chad. You were kind enough to do this interview. We were speaking on this request as a reaction to a recent public meeting at City Hall, where civic officials are hearing all kinds of complaints about an increase in rodent sightings. And so far, they say an educational campaign could help curb this problem. What do you think about that idea?
Well, just like any field, you know, if you're looking to better your education on a topic, you want to go to the authority, the person with the most knowledge, to get the most out of that. Now, I know that we weren't invited, you know, as a company. Now, that's not to say that they didn't leverage a different company. I didn't attend that public meeting. I haven't had a chance to check and see if it's online or not. But if the education standpoint is going to go from anything other than the appropriate information source, so in this case, the complaint is about pest control. Well, you know, if you had a question about pest control, you could Google it and get other homeowners' opinions. You know, it's kind of like a review on a product. But if you had access to a professional, wouldn't you want that professional's knowledge? You know, I try to encourage people all the time, you know, call me. You know, don't bother to Google it. Just call me. I love to give free expert advice to people. I love to talk about what I do, obviously. So my only kind of condition or caveat around an education campaign is, where is the information for the education campaign going to come from? You know, because, for example, you know, like a wildlife expert, or, you know, even like the Department of Natural Resources, they, you know, even though they do licensing for us, right, environment does that, they're not necessarily who I'm going to pick to educate me on the topic. That might not be the focus of their profession. You know, they're not a specialist. So I would hope that the information that's given to homeowners is accurate and helpful and pragmatic. There's lots of unrealistic things that you can do. You know, if you have rats underneath your baby barn, for example, I could turn around and say, you should lift that up and pour a slab. Well, that's a little bit overkill, I think, in most cases. You know, it's sure, it's a, you know, it's workable advice, but it might not be practical. So whenever we do rodent work, we always do a site inspection of the property to try to educate around conducive conditions, easy things, affordable things that homeowners can do to reduce the likelihood of rats even being attracted to the property. It's critical. So it's always going to be hard to give blanket advice. There are some things that, you know, your green bin shouldn't be right next to where you park your car, for example. That's a pretty, you know, easy, quick and easy thing that everybody should be aware of. But the problem with general information is it's just that. You know, there's only so many topics that are kind of ubiquitous to everybody who's going to get that advice. So I'll reserve judgment on what the advice actually is. You know, obviously I have concerns anytime that any potential customer of mine is being advised by anybody other than me. I hope that they get good advice, right? Because unfortunately, there's a lot of bad advice out there, you know, especially on the internet. There's just some really unfortunate information out there that isn't helpful to people, and people waste time and money on things that aren't going to help them. And that's really what I wouldn't want to see out of the whole thing.
So a homeowner gets to the point of being exhausted. Let's say they decide they've wasted too much time and money, like you say, and they want to call in an expert. But maybe they might be a little bit embarrassed and they don't want the neighbors to see an exterminator's truck in the driveway.
It's funny because the first person, you know, quite often it happens, you know, just by the nature of my work. And thankfully, you know, the majority of my customers seem to be happy with what I do. So I get a lot of referrals. And it's always kind of funny where somebody gets to the point where they're frustrated enough to disclose the problem to coworkers or friends or what have you. And then all of a sudden, it's almost like you get inducted in a little secret society when everybody opens up because now, you know, you're part of the club. And, you know, all these stories come out. And quite often people will say, you're just wide-eyed and amazed that, you know, I hadn't heard any of this before. And once, as soon as I basically came out and admitted that I was part of the club, then I got, you know, all this support, referrals and all this. So there's a lot of stigma around, you know, pest control issues in general. You know, you don't have to be doing anything wrong for all kinds of critters to find your house agreeable. I mean, I tell people all the time, if you like the house, they like the house. That's it. There's no, because you have to remember, from a rodent perspective, you know, it's not about heat or food. Well, that's a bit of a misnomer. Those things are fantastic, and they'll take them if they can get them, right? But the thing that your house offers that you can't get in nature is there's nobody in the house to eat me. That's a pretty big advantage, right? You know, I'll figure out a nice cozy nesting spot, and I'll figure out snacks for later. But if I can sleep safely and know that nobody's going to get me, well, then it's everything else is basically gravy, right? So very famously, you know, when it comes to property values, the style of house since, you know, in the 90s that has the highest property value typically has an attached garage, right? And this is a story I tell to people who kind of, they're a little down in the dumps about the situation, maybe because they have an older house, they feel that the things are stacked against them. Well, you know, in neighborhoods with, you know, every house has double attached garage, you can't get a garage door that's going to keep rodents out if they want in. So all those houses with those, you know, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 real estate tag, I've been in half of them because they have a conducive condition to rodent entry, right? So it has nothing to do with, you know, the house. And quite often the old house thing, it pops up a lot where people are discouraged because, you know, they own a house that's, you know, 70, 80 plus years old. Well, I think, you know, we in North America are a little bit jaded because, you know, if you go over the pond, geez, they've got an awful lot of really old houses. You don't think that they put up with this kind of stuff, do you? Right? Just because their house happens to be built in the 1500s or something. there's always something that can be done to improve the situation, whether it's a company house that's 100 years old or, you know, a brand new semi-detached that's 7 years old. As far as the rodent is concerned, they love them both because they both offer the same thing, right? Safety. It's just how easy do you make it for them to get in? That's the key, right? Exclusion, that's typically what we call it in my business, should always be the first thing you're trying to achieve. Right? Keep them out, keep you in. Let them enjoy life as a wild critter outside, and you can stay, you know, unauthorized tenant free in your nice house. That should always be the goal, right? So stigma plays a massive role in basically the people's willingness to accept help. Some people are really cavalier about it because the, whatever it is, the disgust or the fear or the just the degree to which they're fed up with the problem outweighs any other concern, which those people are great. You know, they're not going to mess around and they're going to get the help that they need right away. It's unfortunate when you get into a situation where people have basically tried everything they can do to avoid bringing that notice, having that truck maybe with some signage in the driveway, you know, and that's a little sad to see. We're all dealing with it, you know, rich, poor, big and small, the whole nine yards. It's something that's universal to all of us. There's, you know, like I said, do you like the house? They like that.
Do you think you'd get even more business, Chad, if you decided to go incognito to visit a client?
Well, that's a valid concern. And to be perfectly honest, most pest control companies, ours included, you know, typically incorporate an unmarked vehicle of some kind. You know, within reason, you know, because obviously, so for example, in this case, my work vehicle, my truck is completely advertising, you know, I'm all in on that. Both doors, you know, you can quite clearly see what I do from the, you know, to driving behind me. Whereas my business partner, Kevin, Kevin drives an unmarked truck. So, for some people, that is a big concern because they don't want, you know, they don't want anybody to know, right? When quite often what actually happens in my experience is in those circumstances where somebody's worried about, you know, what the neighbors will think, what ends up happening is the neighbor ends up cheating over when I'm in the middle of doing stuff and starts to pick my brain because they're in the same boat, right? And then it kind of breaks the ice. And then sometimes that's absolutely fantastic because you may have three properties on one side of the road. They're all struggling. None of them know that the others are struggling. Then all of a sudden you get a little, a collaborative effort going because it's now out in the open. So it can go either way. You can always kind of up, you know, confidentiality is pretty important in my business. I don't go talking about my customers' problems, you know, just for that obvious reason. You know, people don't want to necessarily advertise that they needed our services, but it depends on the service. You can imagine that the response to somebody who had, you know, rats underneath their garbage bin, for example, at the end of the driveway. Well, I'm pretty sure everybody's on board that.
Okay, Mr. Chad Fleming of Island Pest Control. Thanks so much, Chad. Anything you'd like to add?
I think the moral of the story is if you need help, it's available, and we're always available for, you know, just a call to ask a question. You know, that would probably be the biggest takeaway for anybody who's concerned. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, some people are concerned about the expense or whatever. But experts are there, and quite often we're incredibly available, and we like talking about what we do, and we're more than willing, you know, we're in the business of helping people. So, you know, if you have a problem, call somebody. You at least get good, accurate information. And whether that's, you know, quite often there are things that you can do yourself with a little bit of guidance, right? And if the problem is outside the scope of your ability, I'm more than happy to help. But it doesn't hurt to call.
Coming up on Saturday, May 13th, the Coast 89.7 and the Miners Museum present the Lamplight Gala. It's a fundraiser for the Miners Museum. And with me from the Miners Museum, Mary Pat Mumbercat. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
Well, tell us a bit about what's going on that night. Just from reading the stuff online, it sounds like it's going to be a very entertaining evening.
It's going to be great. It's a night of music, of food, all kinds of entertainment. And anybody who was at last year's Lamplight Gala will know that it is just jam-packed and just a spectacular evening. So we're really looking forward to doing that one more time.
And it's taking place, of course, at the Miners Forum in Glace Bay.
And last year we had it there. We had it when the ice was in. So it's a little nippy. So this year there's not going to be any ice, so we're expecting it to be a much warmer evening so women can wear their strapless dresses if they so desire. So we're really looking forward to this one.
So how many people can this event hold?
We're going for 400. So there's going to be 40 tables of 10, and the food's going to be catered by Scott from Flavor, and music. We're keeping the music on the down low this year. Last year, we had surprise guests, and everybody was just blown away. Last year was Bruce Guthrie was our surprise guest. So this year, we thought, besides Men of the Deep, so of course, they're going to be at the Miners Museum Gala. We're going to keep everybody sort of a secret until you get there, but believe you me, the entertainment is Cape Breton royalty, and people are going to be impressed.
Well, I see where you're going with that. Tight-lipped again this year.
Yes, yes. It was so much fun last year when Bruce came out and everybody just went wild. So we're hoping to do that all over again.
Of course, and he has a relationship with the Men of the Deep. And, of course, singing that song, Men of the Deep, so I'm sure he performed that last year.
He absolutely did. And yes, you're right. His father was a miner and his brother is a miner. His brother actually sings in the Men of the Deep. So Bruce's family, people that are going to be on stage with the Men of the Deep, they're pretty much family too, so it's going to be a fabulous night.
Okay, so tight lip for a reason, and it's going to be a surprise when you get there. You know it's going to be a great night, so if you've got special guests, hors d'oeuvres, prizes, and so much more, and somebody that's going to come out from behind the curtain, you're going to go, oh my goodness.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's just such a fun evening, and it goes so fast. Like, I mean, you just sit down, and all of a sudden, the night's over, and you think, holy cow, where did that go? It's one of those evenings. And last year, just about everybody who was there has called and said, you know, book me a seat or book me a table. So we're really looking forward. So if anybody out there is interested in a seat or a table, get in touch with me right away.
849-4522, that's the number?
That'll reach me, you bet, over the phone, or we can do it through email.
And you don't want to miss out on this because you know it's going to sell out. And, of course, the money raised is helping out the Miners Museum, which is a great influx of funds to keep the Miners Museum going.
It's actually helping with our rebuild. So this money is going to sort of the refurbish the Men of the Deep Theater. So that hasn't been done in many, 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 many years, and it's pretty rough around the edges. So we're really looking forward to having a home that fits the Men of the Deep. Anybody who comes will be helping create a better home for the Men of the Deep.
And again, it's coming up on Saturday, May 13th. It's the Lamplight Gala featuring premium entertainment, which is under wraps right now. Special guests, hors d'oeuvres, also prizes and more. And, of course, an elegant evening. It's at the Miners Forum at Glace Bay at 7 o'clock. And Mary Pat, again, that number is 902-849-4522. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Bill.
To be Acadian, I guess, historically speaking, would be the ones that first inhabited, the first Europeans to settle in North America. In 1605, with Samuel de Champlain, they settled in the St. Croix River, and then they moved to Port Royal, down by Annapolis County, down in the valley. And then we prospered there for a couple of hundred years. And in 1755, the expulsion of the Acadians was ordered by Charles Lawrence. And we ended up being put on boats, a lot of them. Half of them that were put on board drowned on the way wherever they were going. And the other half ended up in Port L'Espérance, that would be in New Brunswick, on the way to the North Shore. And some of us made it here. Some of them even starved to death in the winter because they couldn't get enough food. We managed in the fishery, between the fish and what we could eat. And the First Nation helped us a lot in feeding us and kept us alive. 3 years after the deportation, we were burnt out of here by a fellow by the name of James Wolfe that took Quebec in 1759. On the way to take Quebec City, Admiral Amherst ordered him to burn all the French settlers' settlement on Caperton Island. And Ile Madame was one of them. Five or six years after, the Robins arrived, and they were worse. The Robins were Huguenots from the Isle of Jersey between England and France. They spoke French, but they were British subjects. Well, the Robins had their money where they paid their fishermen, and their fishermen could only negotiate that in their stores. The condition was this, that as soon as a round fish hit the bottom of the boat, it belonged to the company. So the only thing that the Acadians could take home to feed their family were the waste of the fish, like the big the vertebrae of the fish, as well as the heads. But that's all they had. So they kept the Acadians in debt, poor, and they kept them illiterate. They weren't allowed their education. In my day and the day before, education was frowned upon because those educated people, they cheated people. The entrepreneurs, they cheated people. They were bad, you know, in that sense. So grandpa wasn't exactly overwhelmed for you to become an entrepreneur because they would make money on the backs of the poorer people. And he said that was not right, you know, so. Once you're what you would call crushed, it takes a long time to come back up to feel good in your own skin. And we felt that over the years, that we were never good enough. We never knew our history. And those who talked about us didn't know us in the first place because it was never us talking. You know, when a Jerseyman writing in the paper said that the relationship between the Huguenots and the Acadians were amicable, that they got along very well. Well, it depended on what side of the fence you were sitting on. To him, yeah, because he had all the benefits. But to the Acadians, it was another story. You know, even after all the assimilating factor that arrived, we can still sit back and have a laugh amongst ourselves, speaking our language. And it gives me a sense of pride.
On Dialogue this week, we're speaking with Mr. Gabriel LeBlanc, a retired teacher and author. And you just heard him speak on a YouTube video series that was called The Acadians' Beginnings, and that's produced by the Cape Breton Acadian Project. Of course, it's a story that warrants more than just a five-minute YouTube clip, Mr. LeBlanc. It can be a long and complicated story, but one thing, if you wouldn't mind speaking to, something most people are familiar with around here is the unique bond shared among the Acadian and the Mi'kmaq people. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, I think that the simple result was that the Acadians devoted themselves to being a sedentary people. In other words, they farmed in the same location, while the Mi'kmaq were usually more transitory. You know, they followed the
the game and in season. And therefore, but they were always welcome amongst the Acadians. And we didn't try to change them, but we certainly adopted a lot of their ways in order for us to survive. And they taught us really how to dress properly, how to make shelters, how to travel the forest, how to use the river as main roads between one location to another. They taught us how to fish, how to make traps. And these were all because the Acadians traditionally in France were farmers, and they had to come here and they had to adapt to a lot of different things in order to survive. And the First Nations were the people that shared their knowledge with us. But as you know, that in the books of laws of Nova Scotia, there are still, what you call laws that prohibit Acadians and the Mi'kmaq to assemble. And you're not allowed to have Mi'kmaq coming into your houses. And even at that, there were several cases in Nova Scotia. If you want to cite one of the best Mi'kmaq historian, Daniel Paul, he will go into details with you on these laws. And they're still in the books in Nova Scotia. They haven't been rescinded.
When we talk about this special relationship between the Acadian people and the Mi'kmaq, did they find something in common to bring them closer together along the lines of maybe ill treatment under the British flag, where they would have this in common? Did this bring them closer together?
Well, to some extent, but we never tried to change the First Nation. We adopted them as our friends the way they were. We didn't impose anything on them. As a matter of fact, we looked upon them, and if you look into the Order of Good Cheer, as equals. You know, they accepted our religion, true, but on the other hand, we took a lot from them that they shared that enabled us to survive. And even on the island here, in 1758-59, when Louisbourg was blown out of the water, all the French villages from Madame to Louisbourg were set on fire by a fellow by the name of James Wolfe under the generalship of Amherst. And because of that, a lot of Acadians went to northern New Brunswick, but some of them stayed around the Bradour Lakes with the First Nations. And they looked after us for 7 years. They fed us, they sheltered us, and they looked after us. And, I mean, we owe them a lot of gratitude for it, but very little is said about it in the school books.
Another common denominator for Mi'kmaq and Acadian people is the important role that oral history plays and how information has been passed down over generations. Can you elaborate on that, Gabriel?
Well, yes, because the Acadians, as you know, under the Jerseyman regime on Isle Madame, they kept the Acadians in debt, poor, and illiterate. So the only way of communicating our history would be through oral tradition and stories, and which I would assume that we adopted from the same nations, from the First Nations, because their history is a oral history.
You mentioned the Acadian expulsion from the mid-1700s in the video a moment ago. Of course, again, hard to sum that up in just a few sound bites, but we're all familiar with names like Doucette and LeBlanc, Acadian names here in the Maritimes, a very rich Acadian presence on the island, and in other places like Louisiana. Can you explain how that happened, please?
Well, if you, I think Farringer, who was the head of the history department at Yale University in Connecticut, I think he wrote the great and noble scheme, which is the history of the expulsion. And to him, there is a link between what you would call the Revolutionary War in the States, the United States becoming independent from England. And most of these loyalists didn't want to go back under the feudal system in England, but they needed space to settle. And they coveted the Acadian lands because the Acadians were doing very well in farming, especially down the valley and down to Maine and southern New Brunswick. And he's convinced that because the orchestration of the expulsion came from the 13 colonies and not necessarily from Britain. And, of course, Lawrence, who was governor of Nova Scotia at the time, was in favor of that. So he orchestrated the whole thing. And the ships they used to expose them were ships that were no longer seaworthy in the 13 colonies, and they were used to displace the Acadians. And in many cases, like in Carolina and those areas, the Acadians became the white slaves of the area. They were indigenous peoples. And Louisiana was really, at that time, a Spanish possession, and they wanted more Catholics and people to populate the area. So that's how they ended up there. And they stayed in the bayous in the south because they didn't have to get in contact with the authority of the 13 colonies. As you know, they wanted to stay neutral. They didn't want to swear allegiance to the king. The Acadians were mostly Roman Catholics, and the king was the head of the Anglican Church. So they felt they were betraying their own religion and their own, belief in the Pope and the Catholic doctrine. And they wanted to stay out of it, you know, when the superpowers fought. And it was used as the excuse to expel them. But it certainly wasn't. It was more or less what Fallinger noted in his book, that there was a larger scheme or reason than just the neutrality to stay neutral. We are the first generation that get an education, that are illiterate. Before, both my parents were illiterate, poor, and because of the merchants that were around, but it was somewhat like Sydney and the steel plant. You know, they pay you with what you would call coupons from the company store, and they were only negotiable at the company store. So you can imagine why the strikes at the steel plant and in the mines, when it occurred, you can see that, that should have never happened. You know? But certainly, and I am the first one, the first Acadian of El Madame that is writing about Acadian culture in French. Otherwise of that, we were always told what we were, and not necessarily truthful. If you remember the story of Nova Scotia, which was our grade six history book in school, there was an Acadian woman, an Acadian man, each holding a pitchfork, and they had a big pile of hay between them. And we were told they were farmers. And I wanted to know what the hell we were doing in Pedigree on a pile of rocks. And that's how that's what motivated me to become an historian and do research. And also, when you read the paper that you get these clergymen that will tell you that the relationship between the Acadians and the Jerseymen were amicable. They got along very well. But I always said, and I still do, that it depended on what side of the fence you were sitting on. These things that I ran across that motivated me, and the only one that gave me some solaces into my culture was Daniel Paul. Because Daniel Paul is a Mi'kmaq who wrote about the Mi'kmaq people, in several books, and one of them in particular, We Are Not the Savages. And I think if we had followed a lot of the First Nations philosophy, we wouldn't be in the mess that we are today as far as the fisheries, the forests, the situation, the natural resources, because they only took what they needed, and they didn't super exploit it like they did the fishery.
You know, it's so impressive when you hear Acadian people here or other multilingual Cape Bretoners switching back and forth from one language to another, much grace and very fluidly. It may sound incredibly naive, sir, but can you explain how you can tell the difference between Acadian French, French in Quebec, and French in France, and how they are different?
You ever take a Newfoundlander from the outports of Newfoundland, a New Yorker, a Texan, and a Massachusetts fellow, as well as a guy from Sydney, and put them all together? And the same situation happens with the English language. The Newfoundlanders still speak the 17th century English that they had, the Shakespearean English. So they have they accentuate different syllables in words. But once you develop the ear to him, he's not a problem to understand. You know, and the thing is that we have to develop a certain amount of tolerance. And most of these differences were caused by isolation more than anything else. You know, we use a lot of marine terms in our language here because that's the only thing that we knew was fishing and getting a living out of the fishery. So we don't say au barque de la voiture. You know, we say au barque. We don't say mot. But the Quebec French would say mot de la voiture. But we say our bark is an embarkation, which is a boat. We say, well, get in it, you know. So that there is a nuance, but that's what makes the Acadian language really flavorful, because we have Mi'kmaq words in it. We have English words. We have Basque words in it. And a lot of words that we use that was used in the 17th century that are no longer used today, we still use today. For example, we don't say fenêtre, we say a châssis. We don't say a wall, we say a robbery. But those words, if you look at the writings of Molière and Rabelais, you will see those words in their writings. You have the different games, wildlife, we say ciboula. Cibou is a word in Mi'kmaq for a duck or a wild bird. We have also garon, a different that we have used the Mi'kmaq word because we didn't know what they were when we arrived here. So we adopted the First Nation word for it. And we have also some fish that weren't common, in France. They would adapt the First Nation term.
Mr. LeBlanc, that was very interesting. I hope we can catch up again and continue to talk about the YouTube series. Once again, it's called The Acadian's Beginnings, and it's produced by the Cape Breton Acadian Project. Thanks so much, sir, and have a good day.
Okay, well, thank you. If I can be of some help, I'd be more than happy to participate.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.